This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, a sequel to the smash hit Black Panther opens in theaters midnight tonight, nationwide tomorrow, but without the title character. And we'll talk with a UW Green Bay professor about the history and cultural significance of this comic book character and get a preview of the new film. Now, in the lead up to Tuesday's midterm elections, pundits predicted a so-called red wave, red tsunami of Republican victories across the country that would give the GOP significant majorities in the House and Senate. As it turned out, there was no such wave in most states, and the analysis now is that Democrats exceeded expectations. But who set those expectations? Where did those expectations come from? The results raise questions about how well the media covers election issues and where coverage can improve next time around. And you can join us with your point of view at 1-800-642-1234. What kind of media coverage did you consume in the lead up to the election? And did you set your expectations for how election night would go? Let us know. 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@WPR.org. Our guest, Mike Wagner, professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He holds affiliations with the Department of Political Science and the La Follette School of Public Affairs, and he's a faculty affiliate at the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. And Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
It is great to be here.
Yeah, it's not easy. You can't paint an election media with a broad brush and generalize across the board, but I know I'm going to ask you to do just that. How well do you think the midterm elections were covered by the mainstream and nonpartisan media?
I think there were some successes in terms of the mainstream media doing a pretty good job highlighting how the election count process works. And so saying, look, we're not going to know everything on election night, talking about why it is there are big dumps of ballots at these seemingly random times that aren't actually random at all, but planned out in advance. And so preparing voters for that, I thought they did a great job. There was a lot of probably too much coverage of the polls and certainly a little too much leeway taken with the narratives about what to expect, or at least not grounding those in the evidence from which they came. And so there was definitely some ways many news organizations fell short when we think about the election coverage in that way.
Some headlines leading up to the election day on Tuesday. Democrats on defense in blue states brace for red wave in the House. A red tsunami watch. The Republican wave is building fast. Headlines come from the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, Axios, and Politico. But where did this narrative come from?
Well, it came from a lot of places. It came from different news organizations, of course, and more partisan and ideological pundits who comment on politics. But, you know, just because there are expectations doesn't mean that those expectations were crazy, right? The expectation was the Green Bay Packers would beat the Detroit Lions.
Those were the expectations, right?
And it wasn't a weird expectation. They almost always beat the Detroit Lions, right? So that's not weird to expect it. And if we just look at history in midterms, we would have expected 20 to 25 seats in the House going to Republicans, 4 or 5 seats going to the in the Senate going to Republicans as well. And that would have been enough to give them clear majorities in both houses. And so that's not just using history and not any candidate running for office, any issue, just using that as a baseline, that's a reasonable expectation. I think where coverage and the narratives fell short was to try to think about what is unique about what's happening now, one of which is our divisions are just further entrenched. And so there are less voters up for grabs than there typically are. There's less persuadable voters. And so that's one reason these waves might not happen in as large of numbers as we might have expected them before. Another is that there were really unique issues happening in this election that pushed back against this red wave narrative, most notably the overturning of the Roe versus Wade decision and the Dobbs Supreme Court decision during the summertime. That galvanized many Democrats and excited people who tend not to participate in politics or might normally vote for Republicans, but in this one case saying, well, I don't like what's happened here, and so I want to vote for candidates who are going to bring policies back to their own priors on the abortion issue. And so there were a few different things kind of all happening at once that didn't get as much of attention in the narrative construction of what we were expecting.
Do we in some way make the mistake of putting all media into one bucket, the pundits, the prognosticators, the predictors, and then the actual journalists who aren't who aren't saying this is what's going to happen, but are stuck to the who, what, where, and how.
Right. Most everybody does this. I'm a journalism professor, and I do this sometimes, right? We say the media, but there's no the media. There's not a meeting where everybody shows up and decides on what the narrative is going to be. And so, you know, there are lots of different kinds of news organizations, and then there are people with different roles within the same organization, right? There's some people who work for a newspaper whose job it is to report the verifiable truth. Other people whose job it is to share their opinions. Same on television, especially cable television. And so we kind of conflate these different sorts of things. And in this particular case, it was both sides of both opinion and news helping to create this narrative that there was likely to be a huge night for Republicans that ultimately did not materialize. If we looked at just the polling, we would have been much more skeptical about the red wave claims.
But we've had issues with the polling in the past, and we've covered this on Central Time, that traditionally polling has underpredicted Republican results. And this
it
time
did in 2016 and to a slightly less degree in 2020. And so, you know, it's not bizarre that news organizations would say, well, if that's what's been happening, maybe that's what's going to happen again. It seems to turn out this time that what was undercounted a little bit, but not much, were Democrats or younger, more independent-minded, but also left-leaning people. And so, again, not huge misses, right? Most elections have been within the margin of error of a poll, but most news organizations don't highlight that margin of error. They say, you know, Johnson is up by 3. Well, yes, but if the margin of error is 3, they might be tied.
And that gives you 6 points
right.
overall
That's
where
right.
that result could fall, which means for some of these polls, they weren't wrong. They were just within that margin of error.
They're estimates. Votes are the actual score, and polls are estimates.
Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Stephen in Wauwatosa is standing by. Stephen, you're on the air with Mike Wagner, journalism professor at UW-Madison.
Yeah, hi. I was going to talk a bit to what you just mentioned about the polls. And Nate Cohn with the New York Times wrote a really strange article in my mind and September saying pollsters didn't correct for any of the mistakes they made in 2020. And so we should expect that they favor Republicans again. And that just didn't turn out to be the case at all. And it's sort of kind of silly to think that pollsters wouldn't try and correct for the mistakes that they've made. And so basically the lesson is that polling error is kind of random, is well within the margin of error most times. And to predict it is you know, just a complete guess. And so the media really should either trust the polls or ignore them completely. But trying to add on this sort of like the adjustment for past polling error just doesn't really work. And I think that really did drive a lot of the red wave talk because the polls were pretty accurate this time, and it was really just the narrative that the polls were going to overcount Democrats again that caused us to expect a red wave that just never happened.
Stephen, thank you for the call. Pollsters have told me that they can predict what people feel about the issues, but they can't predict people's behavior, whether or not they're actually going to go cast a ballot, and that to some degree can be a challenge for predicting the outcomes of these elections using polls. Are we making a mistake in using these polls for election outcomes and the candidates?
Well, polls are a snapshot in time. They're not the same thing as an election. They tell us a lot of information about how people are thinking about an election, but it's just not the same thing as showing up to vote or filling out an absentee ballot. And I do think, you know, that Stephen is onto something with the comment about how a lot of the coverage said, well, the polls are really close, but we're not going to quite trust them, and we're all going to systematically not quite trust them in the same direction, which helped build this expectation about a red wave. When we think about polling error, we hope and we assume that it's random. Some research that looks into polling error has found consistently that we tend to be systematically underestimating people who are less well off economically. And so in 2016 and 2020, a lot of those were white folks who supported Donald Trump. But in 2022, these might have been more younger folks of more diverse demographic backgrounds who were a little bit more left-leaning but also less economically well-off. These are folks who are just less likely to answer public opinion surveys, especially when they're conducted by phone.
And I've seen this with – I want to ask about the influence that candidates and political parties have over the media narrative, because I've seen this with political debates, with setting expectations. And but do we also see this with election outcomes as well, trying to set the expectations so that it's not so shocking?
Parties definitely do that. You especially see that before debates, where you have this whole campaign season where the campaign talks about what a great candidate they have, and then a week before the debate, oh gosh, they're probably going to get killed in this debate because the other person is such a great debater and our person never gets to do it. And they always – there's this expectations game that kind of happens. And another thing that happens is that journalists are, you know, often trained to be skeptical. And so if the historical evidence is the Democrats are going to have a bad night, if the polling evidence is mixed and looks competitive but with the historical evidence, and then the Democrats say, hey, we're doing great, the journalists might say, well, of course you're going to say that. You're trying to keep your voters happy. They're looking for motives. And then they might even become more reactive and more negative to that argument from one side. And so journalists might be sensitive to that. And, of course, journalists are sensitive to being called biased. And so they, you know, and especially being called liberally biased. And so when Democrats say, hey, it's actually looking better for us, reporting that in an environment where we know that typically it should be a good night for Republicans, that opens them up, opens reporters up to being called biased. If they had said, oh, well, gosh, you know, maybe it's not going to be so bad for Democrats, we probably would have heard a lot more complaining about the nature of the news coverage itself.
So would you say that part of this media narrative about the midterm elections on Tuesday was a conservative bias?
It's possible. I would say that most kind of mainstream news organizations' main bias is toward centrism and trying not to take sides, even when the verifiable truth is on one side or the other.
But did you try so hard that you ended up being on the other side?
That can happen. I think that can happen. You know, sometimes reporters are, you know, like the extreme example is, you know, you're standing out in a rainstorm and say, well, some people say it's sunny. You know, we don't want, you know, like those are things where journalists, you know, need to be able to make calls about the verifiable truth, but sometimes are loath to do so for those fears.
Mike Wagner, journalism professor at UW-Madison, talking today about the red wave that never came to fruition. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What did you think of the election coverage you saw this year? And what do you think was well covered? What do you think could have been done better? Let us know. 800-642-1234. After all, we're the media too. You can also email us ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues next on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and we're picking up our talk with Mike Wagner, journalism professor at UW-Madison who studies media and politics, with us today looking at how the media covered the midterm elections and where we could have done better. And you talked about past as prologue before, Mike, and I want to hear a little bit from the coverage of the PBS NewsHour on election night with Judy Woodruff interviewing House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And here's the House Speaker rebuffing the narrative of the historical trends in that interview.
I have always objected to the presentation, the media thread that was out there. You can't win because it's an off year. So who cares? We have great candidates who have confidence and courage to run because they believe and they know why they're running. And they know that our democracy is at stake, our planet is at risk, but also that you win these elections on the kitchen table issues.
Mike, do you win these elections on the kitchen table issues?
That's one way. There are lots of things that matter, right? So from the very fundamental in terms of how popular is the president and how many seats do you have that are competitive that you have to defend and all of those kinds of things matter. But these kitchen table issues matter too, right? People care about the state of the economy. They care about whether they have a right to an abortion or not. You know, these are things people care about. And when the issue is really important to them, it can become a voting issue. And campaigns, of course, are trying to raise the importance of some issues in voters' minds, right? So like, for example, Senator Johnson wanted voters to be thinking about crime when they went to the voting booth, right? Whereas, you know, Mandela Barnes wanted voters to be thinking about abortion when they went to the voting booth because those issues benefited them in the election cycle. And so these issues definitely matter. They're one of many things that matter. And in a state like Wisconsin, where 20 to 50,000 votes can be the difference, 1% here, 0.5% there are deciding who wins.
Let's go back to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Lisa and Madison standing by. Lisa, good afternoon. You're on the air with Mike Wagner.
Hi. I just wanted to say that the media was right on about Gen Z showing up on election day to vote. I worked a campus polling location from 6 a.m. to close that day. And by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we ran out of ballots and were having to use the electronic ballots until we could get more. And every campus location did have to request ballots. We were just the first to run out. But those kids, they waited up like a half an hour or more to register to vote that day, and then they had to wait for a booth to open, and it was just a constant flow of traffic from them. They really showed up that day.
I appreciate the perspective from where you were on Election Day, Lisa. And Mike, there were some things that the media got right, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the coverage about the importance of abortion, inflation, crime, the importance of covering how elections are tabulated and the rules about those things. Like, those are things I thought the news media did very well. And I would say that the national news I was checking out here and there on election night were also doing a very good job of reminding voters it's not that all of a sudden, you know, Evers swings into the lead or Michaels takes the lead. It's the votes are in. There's already a winner. We're just counting. And we're just counting until we know who won. It's not like a football game where somebody could throw a Hail Mary on the last play of the game and win the game. The polls are closed. The votes are in. We're just counting. And that's something I think the news media has done a much better job of explaining to people. Now, could they do a better job of explaining other fundamental issues in the election in the month preceding the election? Yes, they could.
Let's go back to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Diane and Baldwin's on the air. Diane, you're with Mike Wagner.
Yes, I wanted to mention that I don't normally tell people who I am voting for. And the Democrats, I voted Democrats because the Republicans are deniers of the vote, you know, the presidential vote. And there's so many people that are angry about that.
Oh, I think we lost you there, Diane.
It reminds me of the of Trump. Reminds me of Putin. We have all this information showing that he has lied about things, and yet we put blinders on. Putin, he doesn't even allow his people to hear any of the outside information.
Dan, let's get a reaction from Mike Wagner. And one of the things I did not see were some of the conspiracies bubbling up on Election Day, although social media had some stories, but they were quickly rebuffed. There did not seem to be any of the big lie that came from the 2020.
Yeah, here in Wisconsin, there wasn't very much of it. And what did begin to percolate on social media was quickly knocked down by local news sources. But the other thing that happened, right, was that, you know, late in the night, early in the morning, I forget the precise time, you know, Tim Michaels conceded the election. And so this is how democracy is supposed to work. He did the exact right thing. He waited until there wasn't a mathematical chance for him to catch up. He didn't need to concede when there was still maybe some opportunity to show that his votes in a particular place, you know, worked out better than maybe they had thought. But once it was mathematically impossible for him to come back, he conceded the election. And when that happens, when our elites, especially the people from our party, tell us that it's over, we are way more inclined to believe it. And so that's the kind of thing that we need to see more of in our politics.
Diane, thank you so much for the call. And so you and I are members of the media, but we have to be media consumers like everybody else, too. So how do we go about being more savvy when it comes to political coverage? What can we do better as media consumers, Mike Wagner?
I think as consumers, we can give our attention to stories that are covering issues and give our attention to stories that are covering the performance of candidates in office. Attention is a valuable resource. Where I spend my clicks, where I spend the time with my eyeballs watching something or reading something, sends signals to news organizations about how they can market themselves to advertisers to, you know, help their bottom line. And so if we spend more time trying to learn about what it is candidates want to do and how effective they have been at trying to do it in the past, then we spend on what's the latest estimate in the polls and how are the aggregated polls on 538 making this or that or the other, making it look like I'm going to have a good night or my side's going to have a bad night, the better off we're going to be. But, you know, it's fun to look at those things. And that's the part of the problem, right? It's you know,
you go to the horse race. You can always, you know, go to the horse race.
There was this old Saturday Night Live sketch when Al Gore was running in 2000 and Daryl Hammond's playing Al Gore. And they said, all right, everybody, open your textbooks to page 245. You know, people, you know, need to learn about issues, but we need to find ways maybe to make that more exciting and help audiences understand how vital these issues are to their lives.
So the media has a responsibility here to maybe the horse race is innately exciting, but to some way turn that and that excitement towards the issues that people actually go to the polls for.
That would be useful. But of course, we as people who use the news also have a responsibility to try to search out things that are going to help us understand how the world works better, rather than just looking for stuff that says my side's great, your side's bad, or stuff that's about who's winning and who's losing and why, which is not, none of those stories are useful to us anymore because the election is over. Whereas if we'd learned about how does Senator Johnson go about thinking when he's making a big decision, or what was Lieutenant Governor Barnes' success rate at getting his promises enacted into law, those things are still relevant once people start doing the process of governing.
Mike, what are you watching for in the media coverage now after the election? What are you looking for?
Coverage about who's trying to keep their promises and what is in their way or allowing them to be successful. Opportunities to find political compromise. Our system shares power across branches of government and across levels of government, and so it requires compromise. And too often we have sort of empty calls for bipartisanship, but not much in the way of actual bipartisan governing.
So how do you cover that as a journalist, though? You've got the soundbite. You got to use the soundbite or the quote, and it is the lip service to the fact, but how do you add the fact?
It's very easy to point out what percentage of time the votes in legislatures are down straight party lines. Would be something to say, this person talks about bipartisanship but votes with their party 97% of the time or 40% of the time. We know which of those things is the better, more credible estimate of who's serious about being bipartisan. So there's other evidence that reporters can bring to bear on stories that go beyond faithfully reporting what lawmakers say about their intent to be bipartisan or not.
If I made you the news director of a Georgia-based news outlet and you had the Senate runoff on the horizon, how would you be approaching it?
I'd be asking the candidates about their positions on a wide variety of issues that we've learned voters care deeply about related to inflation, crime, abortion, the practice of democracy, the war in Ukraine. These are things that people are saying they care about, and we should demand that these candidates explain their views and what it is they would do as a United States senator to advance the views that they have from a policy perspective.
Mike, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Mike Wagner, journalism professor at UW-Madison, who also holds affiliations with the Department of Political Science and the LaFollette School of Public Affairs, with us today to take a look at what the media got right and wrong in the lead-up to this week's midterm elections. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent will be joined by the leaders from both the Wisconsin Republican and State Democrats. Look at their agenda going forward and what we can expect next in Wisconsin. GOP Chair Paul Farrow and Democratic Assembly Leader Greta Neubauer join Kate tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up after 6 on 1A+, Jen White asks, who showed up for the Democrats? And how many Republicans are now rethinking who they want at the top of their ticket in 2024? That's coming up after 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, tomorrow is the national release for the sequel to Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. Expectations are super high for this superhero film. The 2018's Black Panther was not only extremely financially successful at the box office, it also won a trio of Oscars and was the first movie from the genre to get a Best Picture nomination. In making the sequel, the production team also had to work in the emotional and physical shadow of the late Chadwick Boseman. The actor who played the Black Panther in T'Challa in 2018 died of colon cancer in 2020. And ahead of this new movie's opening, we're going to talk about the historic rise of this particular superhero and where the franchise goes from here after such a difficult loss. And we want to hear from you. Were you a fan of the 2018 Black Panther movie? Are you planning to see Wakanda Forever? And if you've read the graphic novels along the way, what do you have to add to the story? What do you think of the adaptations for the big, big screen? Join us, 800-642-1234, or email us, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Brian Carr. He's an associate professor of communication, information science, and women and gender studies at UW-Green Bay. He is also the author of the book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. And Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a thrill to be here.
And usually we would give you the origin story of a superhero character and where they're coming from, but let's do the real world origin story of the Black Panther. How did this character originate?
So this is a character who originates in issues number 52 and number 53, I believe, of the Fantastic Four series. He is created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. And this was an attempt by Lee and Kirby to essentially try to tell a different story about Africa. If you look at a lot of how Africa and its people were portrayed in comics at the time. It was very regressive, very stereotyped, and quite frankly, very racist. So the attempt was, well, what if we told a story about an African nation with a king who was a scientist, not only a great scientist, but a great warrior, but also led a very technologically advanced nation beyond anything even America and the great Reed Richards and the Fantastic Four could come up with. And so that is really kind of the origin of this. And it's worth noting, he sort of predates the real life Black Panther Party by a couple months. Those issues come out, I believe, the summer of 1966. And then it's a couple months later, we see the Black Panther Party actually start in Oakland, California. So that, as you might imagine, that led to some challenges for Marvel from a branding standpoint for a few years.
So Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, and I think a lot of comic book, every comic book fan would know their names. Here's some middle-aged Jewish guys from New York who created the Black Panther. Were they Afrofuturists? What did they say about their creation?
Well, I would certainly be hard-pressed to say that they were themselves Afrofuturists. I don't think they knew what the word for that would be, because, you know, certainly it wasn't something that was on their mind. I think they definitely saw the opportunity, you know, as you mentioned, these are two middle-class Jewish guys from New York, working-class guys, especially Jack Kirby was. He grew up, you know, he was not from wealth. He was a kid who was going out getting the scraps on the street, that kind of thing. But he had a lot of friends from different cultures, different backgrounds. He had white friends, black friends, and so on and so forth. And, you know, he would say in later years, like, I drew Black Panther because I'd never really put any of my black friends. I had black friends and I never put them in my comics. And I thought this was an opportunity to kind of rectify that. And Stan Lee would also, for his part, kind of talk about like how this was an attempt to, you know, they always said the Marvel universe is the universe outside your door. And so there was this kind of push at a lot of the sort of editorial level of Marvel to include and sort of tell stories from these kind of perspectives and viewpoints you weren't necessarily going to get in a lot of other comics and a lot of other media at the time. Now, again, it should always be noted that, you know, when we talk about comics history, there's always a bit of, you know, ambiguity about the truth and sort of where things came, because nobody's writing anything down and a lot of people want to try to make themselves look good. you know, we know basically that, you know, these were not people writing from the black perspective, but they were certainly people who were sympathetic.
Our guest is Brian Carr, associate professor at UW-Green Bay and author of the book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Now, on to the character itself, T'Challa, the king of Wakanda, who is the Black Panther as a superhero. And one of the things that stands out to me as this superhero is you have Batman, who has all this wealth, Iron Man, who has all this wealth, and their superheroes seem to come from their infinite amounts to spend. You have Spider-Man, who's bitten by a spider. You have the Hulk, who's a radioactive accident. But for T'Challa, where do his superhero powers come from?
So this is actually something they don't really elaborate on too much, but eventually they do reveal. And this is something, you know, when we talk about superheroes, these are especially characters who've been around for a long time, like the Black Panther. There's a lot of kind of tweaks and changes as we go. For instance, when they were first creating those original comics, they hadn't really sketched out Wakanda as a place, right? And so they kind of mentioned, oh, he gets his powers from this herb and stuff like that. And he has the stalking suit and these technological abilities and all this gear and gadgets. And Wakanda is, you know, you mentioned Batman and Iron Man have a lot of wealth. Well, one of the things that makes Black Panther kind of special is that he too has a lot of wealth. You know, he mentions early on, like, I have wealth beyond like pretty much anything anybody knows, right? My nation is incredibly prosperous because we have essentially cornered the world supply of vibranium. And over the years, vibranium becomes this metal that everybody wants. It's essentially a clear allegory and a stand-in from everything from gold to uranium and the Cold War and that kind of thing. And it's this metal that has these incredible properties that allow it to absorb energy and kinetic energy and redirect it and things like that. And over time, essentially, it becomes magic, like really like it's magic. Anything the writer wants vibranium to be, that's what it is. But, you know, this is important in the larger context of these stories, is that, you know, when you look at the historical sort of carving up of Africa by outside nations and Western nations and that kind of thing, a lot of it was, this was a resource rich continent, right? precious minerals, diamonds, all these things. You know, it's, this was all other countries coming to trying to come in and take it. And so that becomes a kind of common theme in a lot of Black Panther stories, is essentially T'Challa trying to stand against the forces of colonization, people trying to take vibranium for their own purposes. And so it becomes this thing where vibranium becomes not only the sort of lifeblood of the economy, but also the sort of the lifeblood of the country itself. Over time, it's kind of revealed that the properties of vibranium kind of go into the herb that the Black Panther takes to get his powers. And this becomes a thing where he is sort of innately tied to the land and the resources of that country.
And that power is then is ancestral. And and this seems to be where the Afrofuturism comes from. But when did Black creators first get their hands on this character, Brian, and begin to grow him, deepen him, and make him more relevant?
So this is a great question, because, you know, for a long time, that wasn't the case. Now, I want to be a couple of things as I answer that question. Number one, Marvel loves to tell the story about, oh, we were very socially, you know, aware and very advanced. They weren't. They really didn't do much with Black Panther for a long time. It wasn't, you know, Don McGregor, another white writer, came in, and McGregor, compared to a lot of the rest of the Marvel offices, was a really progressive firebrand. He worked very closely with a lot of Black artists, was friends with them. He wanted to tell a story about Wakanda and make it specifically a story in Africa with African characters when he wrote the Jungle Action series in the 70s. And so he fleshes out a lot of what becomes sort of Wakanda and Wakandan culture. You know, stuff like the, you know, Killmonger, the Warriors Falls from the movie, all that stuff comes from him, the tribes, the sort of like distrust of outsiders. He delves deeply into that, and he tells like this 12-issue story. But it's not really until the 90s that we actually see Black writers and artists really kind of take the lead. The first is actually the late, great Dwayne McDuffie. He writes, he was a Black Panther fan growing up. He wrote another character called Deathlok, and it, you know, Black Panther didn't have an ongoing series at that time. Again, Marvel didn't really do a whole lot with him apart from a couple of things here and there, but he was a character that people really loved. You know, he's sort of like your favorite comics writer's favorite comics character in a lot of cases. And so, you know, McDuffie was a huge fan growing up. You know, he didn't see a lot of other Black superheroes. And so he talks about, like, this is a character who told me that, you know, Black greatness is possible. It's attainable. You know, it's just really something special. It's not a far-fetched reality. It's something that's right there on the page. And so he writes in a story talking about how, like, you know, Deathlok goes to Wakanda, allies with the Black Panther, talks about how important Black Panther is to him, and by extension, Dwayne McDuffie. And then Christopher Priest comes in the late 90s. And it's funny because, so Priest was this, he'd been a longtime comics editor, longtime comics writer. He'd worked for Marvel and DC. And he comes in and, you know, they're relaunching this imprint called Marvel Knights, trying to make sort of darker, more mature, more adult, complex Marvel stories. And they bring him in. He's like, you guys, please don't give me Black Panther, right? He's like, Black writer, Black Panther, I don't want this character. Because when he grew up with the character, he was just sort of the afterthought. He was the Avengers token Black friend, basically. And so they're like, well, we want to give you Black Panther. And he's like, you know, he's really upset about this, but he's like, okay, I'm going to try to make this character cool and relevant, and not only to Black audiences and Black creators like myself, but also to the white audience, right? And so he comes in, and a lot of, honestly, if there are two people who really heavily contribute to what the kind of contemporary popular conception of Black Panther is, it's McGregor and Priest. Priest makes the character cool. He adds a lot of the gadgets. He makes him this kind of mysterious figure. In fact, we don't really get inside his head very much until late in the run. A lot of it is through the sort of white audience surrogate Agent Everett Ross, who is more of a putz in the comics than he is in the movies, you know, and kind of allows him to kind of make all these sort of like offhand jokes about, you know, race relations and politics that are really, really funny. Some haven't aged super well, but some of them are really funny still to this day. You know, and he treats him as this kind of mysterious figure, and really makes him, like, he draws a lot of influence from Batman in terms of his gadgets and his cape and that kind of thing. He even gives him like a Joker-like villain. And it's really that run that really kind of makes a lot of people step up and take notice, like, hey, the Black Panther's pretty cool. And then after Priest leaves the book, and it's sort of a long fight between him and Marvel. They make him change a lot of things and try to revamp it constantly because it's not selling crazy well, but it's doing critically very well. Reginald Hudlin, who would then eventually become the president of Black Entertainment Television, another Black Panther fan growing up, takes over the character and says, I'm not going to make this anything other than what I think. He's inspired by Malcolm X. He's inspired by Muhammad Ali, Jay-Z, all these cultural figures. T'Challa, the Black Panther, should be cool. He should be hip. He should be relevant. And he does it. And his book, you know, Christopher Priest said, I was trying really hard to make this character appeal to white audiences. And then Hudlin didn't do that, and his book outsold mine exponentially. And he creates Shuri and brings all in all these other characters, and also makes it really like there's a he's not ashamed to pull political punches. He has an issue where T'Challa and Blade and Luke Cage go down to New Orleans after Katrina to help out with cleanup, and there's a lot of pointed critiques of the Bush administration in there.
Wow.
And they also fight Confederate vampires, so comics.
Well, and you mentioned the bringing us Shuri, which brings us to the new movie, which is out midnight tonight, Black Panther Wakanda Forever, the sequel to the 2018 original. And it sets it up perfectly for us with our guest, Brian Carr, Associate Professor of Communication, Information Science, Women and Gender Studies at UW Green Bay, author of the book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. And if you saw the original and are looking forward to the sequel, or if you read any of the comic books, let us know what you thought at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our conversation continues on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and we're continuing our talk with UW Green Bay's Brian Carr about the rise of Black Panther, the socio-political superhero ahead of tomorrow's national release of the movie Black Panther Wakanda Forever. Brian's also the author of the book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. It goes well beyond our discussion here today, which you can still join before we're done with our guest at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And before we get to the sequel, there's one more character in the real world that really had an impact on the Black Panther character in the Marvel Universe, and that is the person who played him in the original 2018 movie, Chadwick Boseman. How did Chadwick change this character, Brian?
So I think you cannot overstate how impactful Chadwick Boseman is. And in the book, I make the case that, you know, we talk a lot about writers and artists and creators, but I think that Boseman and director Ryan Coogler have a tremendous amount of impact, maybe even more than some of the artists and writers, in terms of the cultural consciousness of the character. Here is an actor who fought behind the scenes to do things like they wanted Black Panther to speak with a British accent. He said, no, that makes no sense. This is a character who comes from an uncolonized nation. He shouldn't speak with a British accent. He fought for the Wakandan language to be a real language. They speak Xhosa, a real African language in the film. The most impactful line from the original film, where Killmonger is about to die and he says to be buried at sea with his ancestors who jumped rather than suffer bondage. That was apparently also Boseman's doing. So this is a man who is not only, you know, playing a character on screen. He was truly, truly creatively crafting this character and in a collaborative sense with the writers and the director of the film. And so it was a tremendous loss when he passed, because this is a guy who really was and embodied all the best elements of this character.
So what do we know about how they're handling the death of Chadwick Boseman in this sequel, Brian?
It is difficult to get anything out of Marvel. So we know for sure that there is a new Black Panther in the film. And this, again, squares with the comics. A Black Panther is a title, not a person. There will be a new Black Panther. We know the Black Panther is likely female. Now, if you are a fan of the comics, you know that his sister Shuri does take over as Black Panther for a while. And then of course becomes kind of her own thing when Ta-Nehisi Coates takes over the series for a few years. So the smart money is, well, you know, she's going to be the new Black Panther. And I have no idea. I am not privy to any of this. Marvel did not invite me to the premiere. I'm going to guess that she's on the short list of who's going to replace it. And again, this is a story about legacy in a lot of ways, not just in terms of what the character is in the story, but the legacy of Chadwick Boseman and the larger cultural movement and moment that the original film was. So I think that, you know, it's going to be something where whoever this person is going to symbolically represent that. And as director Coogler says, earn it as well.
Mm. And you mentioned Killmonger, played by Michael B. Jordan in the original 2018 movie, was such a powerful antagonist. Mm-hmm. What do we know about the antagonist that the Black Panther and Wakanda will go up against in this sequel?
You can't see, but I'm smiling really big right now because I'm so excited for this guy. Namor is essentially the king of an underwater nation. It's Atlantis in the comics. It's Talokan in the film. Rather than kind of copy, even though, you know, I always like to tell people Aquaman's the cheap copy of Namor. He came out years after, but Aquaman made a movie first. So they kind of had to reinvent some things about this character. And so they're going with a character who's heavily influenced by Mesoamerican culture, heavily draws from Aztec and Mayan folklore and myth. And again, kind of represents, this is a person who has his own kingdom to look out for. He, you know, there is a lot of, he has a lot of beef with the surface world because we have, of course, poisoned the oceans. We have done all these things. And I don't know what his specific problem with Wakanda is yet, but he represents this kind of thing where he is sort of, in a lot of ways, the inverse of T'Challa, or in some ways the same person, but with a bit of a different moral center. He's traditionally, in his original incarnation, as an anti-hero. He's often been a villain, but he's one of my favorite Marvel characters because he is just this very fascinating, you know, you never quite know where he's going to go. I think they're trying to make him more of a noble anti-hero in this film, and I think that's a good angle. Tanakh Huerta's playing him, and really bringing a lot of, you know, they're bringing a lot of the culture, the language. They worked very closely with actual scholars to pay tribute to and be inspired by that culture, which, again, it was very much in line with what they did with African culture in the first film. So, you know, it's going to be a really interesting way to see how they bring this character in and modernize him.
Brian Carr, do you have your tickets yet?
I do. Yeah, we got them. We're making a whole afternoon of it.
Our guest is the author of The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. Brian Carr is also an associate professor at UW Green Bay. And Neymar is something you're looking forward to. What else are you anticipating in this sequel?
I'm really curious thematically. So I will say this, you know, I think Black Panther in general is kind of a cut above the rest of the Marvel output because it is trying to be a bit more about these heavy ideas and these larger things that are beyond just, you know, the sort of like basic surface level notions of heroism. So what I really want to see is the things that Black Panther does historically well, to talk about the ideas of legacy and power and leadership, to talk about the ideas of, you know, colonization and, you know, how do you right the wrongs of the past? This is something that Ta-Nehisi Coates gets into deeply in his Black Panther run, talking about, like, you know, building on his essay, like, you know, the case for reparations and that kind of thing, talking about the legacy of Wakanda. Is Wakanda itself a good thing? You know, and just casting all of this alongside the idea of grief and loss is really powerful. So I'm really curious to see what one, obviously, the new Black Panther is going to be, but two, how the story goes forward from here. Because there are a lot of different angles and they're introducing a lot of different elements. And we know from what Ryan Coogler has said is that the story is not radically different than the one he had originally turned in, assuming Boseman was going to reprise the role. But it is going to take on a different weight and a different resonance in this context. It's one of those examples where we cannot really separate fiction from the context in which it is written.
So do we know what's next for this franchise, Brian?
We have some ideas. In the comics, we are currently undergoing a story arc where T'Challa is kind of persona non grata in Wakanda. And there is this question about, like, what to do when that vacuum of leadership occurs. Will there be a new Black Panther? Killmonger is being teased to come back. We are also, even though he's dead in the movies, he's still alive in the comics. Nobody ever stays dead in the comics, by the way. Like, it's just like, you, like, dying is like a temporary illness. Like, you get better real quick. But, you know, in the films, we know that there is going to be a Disney Plus series set in Wakanda called, I believe it's called World of Wakanda, but they might have changed that. We don't know exactly what it's going to be about, but presumably we're going to be seeing some stories either from Wakandan history, which could be really, really exciting, or are going to be delving more into the culture and kind of like the, you know, what it's like to be not necessarily the king or the people at the top, but also just like what Wakandan culture and what stories from that place are like. That's going to be a series coming up. I believe Ryan Coogler is going to be very closely involved with that. And of course, these characters are always going to crop up and show up in other media. You know, there's a very good case to be made that, you know, what happens in this film is going to have traumatic implications for the next several years of these films. I've already teased that. So, you know, even though the secrets are what they are, I think that we are certainly going to see a lot more of Black Panther and Wakanda in the future. Possibly even, you know, maybe we will see a different actor take on the mantle once they've had some time to kind of properly process the loss.
It is an entire universe that is open to us, but it also is a part of our universe as well. And the ties between them are fascinating, Brian, and I thank you so much for sharing them with us today.
Thank you.
Brian Carr is an associate professor of communication, information science, and women and gender studies at UW Green Bay. Talk to him today about his book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King, which goes well beyond our conversation here today. We didn't even get to the video games, the TV, and Kendrick Lamar's album, but it's all available for you through his book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. Tomorrow is the national release of the Black Panther sequel, Wakanda Forever. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's Food Friday. Friday, and I'm getting ready. Our guest will be taking us on a guided tour of the Mediterranean, filling up our pantry, adding to our spice rack, and making the smoothest, fluffiest hummus tomorrow on Central Time.